when I say final statements, I don't mean to imply that this is some great big conference with resolutions being passed or anything of that sort. But we would like a chance to hear from some of the folks that haven't said an awful lot thus far. And so what I was going to suggest was that we might hear from Charles Wilkinson and then from Sheldon. Before we do that, however, Rosita, you have a question or two.
Right. I said that leaves Mary and I if you wanted to hear from people who haven't been really active in this discussion. During the last round table discussion, we had a paper presented by Bart Garber. And in that paper, he really outlined some a basic fundamental question that should be addressed in terms of looking at corporations and either altering or changing corporations to take into consideration the basic differences between natives and non-natives. And I think he talked about it in terms of conflicts between individualism and group values of native people. And I think in our discussion of governments, of tribal governments, city governments, and also of laws, we should also be addressing the same question. What are the basic inherent, or if they are inherent, conflicts between the two types of systems? And in my thinking, we go right back into a discussion of looking at individualism and also communalism. And when we look at governments, what are we looking at? We're looking at legitimacy of power, legitimacy of authority. And that legitimacy comes from basic values. And as a student and as a member of Native culture, over and over again, we come back into, you know, very basic differences. And when we talk about tribes, we talk about members of a communal group. And, you know, from, you know, the 1,000 people that have testified before Commissioner Berger, we always hear about survival, control to protect that tribal group, and also control or protection of land. And so, you know, in thinking about it and trying to analyze, what are we talking about? We're talking about, you know, there are some very basic differences. When we talk about land, you know, under the Western system, we're talking about land as a commodity, a product, something that is to be sold and is to be utilized. And in the more recent time, I think we had the Canadian Cindy talk about the new kinds of changes that she sees developing with Western utilization. And we are trying to grapple with that right now, this new type of utilization of land and wildlife resources. And that's the non-consumptive use, or the environmentalists, or conservationists. And we see that now coming into conflict with a native conception or native utilization of land. And land, and in that respect, I'm talking about a relationship that Native people have to their land, both in terms of their, you know, their consumptive, their use of it, their need for wildlife resources, for nutritional and other kinds of economic uses, but also a very spiritual relationship to land. When we transform those into governments and into laws, you know, I don't know how we reconcile the differences. The question that I have for the attorneys, and I appreciate, you know, all of the recommendations that they have given and all of the things that they're telling the commission to address, and also the things that they're telling Native people that they should be doing. But maybe I'd like to ask a question of some of the legal theorists here, is what do they see? I mean, do they see this basic contradiction or basic conflict between tribalism, tribal law, and Western law?
Well, that maybe I could ask Charles Wilkinson, who's writing away there, to take a shot at that, and then as well to offer any other observations. And Murray, did you want to follow up on Rosita's question before we tackle it?
May I?
Yes, please, go ahead.
I would like to just very briefly state something, that our people use words very carefully. And as we deliberate today, I would like to caution the members of this panel to be careful about the words you use when you're talking about us. Such terms as rhetoric and hocus pocus have no place in our world, because we Native people are critically serious about this discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Charles?
I am interested in that question, and I was writing busily, and let me get to that in the framework of what I have to say. I will not take long. My idea here is to throw out to you some general recommendations substantively, but also to talk a bit about the tone and the level of the Commission's report. The first thing that I urge you to do, and when I say you, of course, I'm not really referring just to Judge Berger, but the many people he's drawing upon, his staff, Native leaders, and Native people generally. The first thing I urge you to do is to put this report in historical context, both in terms of looking back and also in terms of looking forward. And by that, I mean this. You must communicate to the people of Alaska and to people in Congress an understanding of what ANCSA was. You cannot change ANCSA until ANCSA itself is understood and the reasons for it are understood. You are still at a point where there is too much blaming going on and arguing over whose fault ANCSA was. It seems to me you need to put that behind you. Now, my personal explanation is roughly this, that ANCSA is best understood as the last act of the termination era. I am one, I have written now for almost 15 years on Indian policy, and often I will ascribe eras or years to different eras, and it always seems they come out different. You pick one year now, and a few years later you decide, well, there's a better way to identify it. Many historians around the table appreciate that. It's now increasingly clear to me that termination began in 1945 when John Collier was forced out of office, and it ended in December 1971 when ANCSA was passed. ANCSA was a termination act. In one book I wrote in 1979, I asked, is ANCSA termination in disguise? I realize now the answer is no. It's not in disguise. It is termination, pure and simple, and you can learn about termination by looking at ANCSA, and you can understand ANCSA only by looking at termination. Now, what that means is that ANCSA was determined by the values of that time, by Senator Jackson having at that time the ability in the time that existed to say to you, there's not going to be any tribalism there. And the inability to say to Ada Deer just 6 months later, there won't be any tribalism there, because he said that to her. And in a different era, literally a different time, she was able to say, yes, there is, Senator Jackson. There's going to be tribalism there. And things had changed just enough so that those balances had tipped. As I suggested to you the other way, it also helps to understand why Alaska Natives and Congress didn't appreciate the options. The options really weren't there. The reasonably sparkling tribal governments in the lower 48 that are doing pretty well didn't exist as models then. And I just think it's wrong for those of you, and I was talking to Charlie Edwardson last night and said, maybe we ought to call ANCSA the Edwardson Act. What we ought to do is recognize the good things that came out of ANCSA that Charlie Edwardson and hundreds of others worked for, the 40 million acres. Well, that's undeniably a good thing. But to recognize that the negative aspect of ANCSA couldn't be fairly predicted then. And it's wrong to ascribe it to malice to Congress. That was just Senator Jackson's view at that time. The tribalism was bad. He hadn't seen much else. He hadn't been forced to see much else, and the natives didn't either. So it seems to me that because ANCSA arose from a policy that is now roundly discredited, and it is termination, that it is acceptable now that we understand where it came from and now that we have had experience under ANCSA to come in and ask for a change. And it's not Alaska Natives somehow going back on a deal. There are not any elements of that if we really work hard on seeing why ANCSA occurred. And it's now a chance for reform legislation, not changing the terms of some kind of an agreement. And what of course came out of ANCSA most basically is that Alaska Natives now, it seems to me, have two basic kinds of protections against encroachment on their land, on their culture, and their resources. And the two basic protections are, first, your geographic remoteness, and secondly, local law. And we have learned in this country and in the other nations that have whose experiences have been brought here, that those two kinds of protections are not enough. And so I think then that there is an immensity here that hasn't been talked about as often as it might have been. And the immensity is that this commission needs to make recommendations that will work in 25, 50, and 100 years. And maybe 50 years is the best time span for you to think in terms of. Please work hard at thinking about what the state of Alaska is going to be like in 50 years. And if you look back 50 years or back to the time of statehood and you start looking at areas like the Bay Area and San Francisco and Los Angeles for the Anchorage area and even outlying areas, the pressure, the inexorable pressure on land and culture and resources is just obvious, and I won't go further than that. It seems to me then that there are three premises here that you need to work off of in building a policy that will work 50 years from now. You need to assume that statewide you're going to have a 95% or 98% non-native population. You need to assume consistently with that many villages are going to have significant segments of non-natives, maybe be in the majority. You have to further assume that subsistence rights are going to be under the worst kind of resource pressure from sports fishers and hunters and from commercial takers of salmon with results that I think are predictable when we look at it in that kind of time span. Now, and then my third premise is that this time now in the mid-1980s is likely to be your best and chance for reform. That my sense is, as one from the lower 48 who does not live up here on a day-to-day basis, although I think I follow Alaska affairs as well as most people in the lower 48, I don't pretend to be a local person, but I believe there are deep and profound movements on Native issues occurring. I think they are changing week by week and month by month, and I think this commission is the most important force, not in the sense that it's creating the pressures, but it's reacting to demands from the villages. But I think this is your chance, and I think you should look at it as your one bite at the apple and recognize that you have to go for true reform now, because you may not get a chance after the 1990 census when the demographics of this state begin, the changes begin to feed into the state legislature. So I urge you to aim at 50 years away, to aim at that population, to aim at those subsistence pressures, and to build your recommendations on the premise that now is the time to go after it. I am heartily optimistic that you can achieve substantial changes. I'm not as optimistic as Reed Chambers that the situation will be acceptable to you in 50 years if changes aren't made. Indeed, my guess is, and again, I'm predicting changes will happen, but I believe if the present system of protections based on remoteness and local law continue, you will have little Native-owned land, your subsistence resources will be cut to the bone, and most importantly, your culture will be threatened from all sides, because you will not have the means to govern in the villages. And that, at least, is my judgment. Again, I think that can be changed. I am absolutely convinced it can be changed. But if something isn't done, that's my sense of the outlook we have. Now, substantively, it seems to me that the centerpiece of your report, which most people here agree on, must be a return to tribalism. I use that phrase tribalism broadly because I don't want for the moment to tie us into the kind of reservation system that is in the lower 48. I believe that this document, the Commission's report, just as it must explain ANCSA, even more fundamentally, must be a burning testimonial to the value of tribalism. It should lay out in no uncertain terms the dignity and beauty of this concept, its ancient origins, its pervasive influence in contemporary international affairs, and its pervasive influence in Alaska until 1971, and the fact that it continues to smolder in the villages. I believe, now to turn to Rosita's question, and I will put it differently, is there a conflict between tribal law and Western law? Tribal law is Western law. That was the first Western law. The question is there a conflict between tribalism and Anglo-American law? On one level, yes. But at the same time, Anglo-American law, which did not include tribalism at the beginning, through the will of Native people, in cases like Worcester against Georgia, in the Cherokee conflict, right up through 1982, in the Supreme Court of the United States, in the Marion decision, and in your movement here, you have forced tribalism into Anglo-American law so that it is now a constituent component of it. It's in our Constitution, it is in the Supreme Court decisions, and so you not only have to, in your report, dignify tribalism, you need to legitimize it in the way that Rosita suggests. And the most basic fact is that tribalism is not an aberration in Alaska, as some would suggest. It's exactly the other way around. Alaska is the aberration because it doesn't have enough recognition of tribalism. And I think you need to make that a banner of your final report. And you need to explain how tribalism as a concept protects against the very things that you consider most devastating. The idea that tribal lands can be sold by individuals, the idea that tribal rights can be inherited. A person passes out of a tribe when they pass out of this life, and new people automatically pass into it. And the idea of tribalism, that there shouldn't be outside control of internal tribal relations. Now, with tribalism, which can determine the three issues that seem to me most important, land, subsistence, and culture, and that apparently has been the reflection from the hearings in the field. In a sense, the means that you use to achieve tribalism, in my judgment, become somewhat less important because your essential job is again, to dignify and legitimize sovereignty and tribalism in the report. But I would throw this out to you on the means of structuring sovereignty. First, the constitutional amendment is a good idea, not because it will be passed, but because it symbolizes your search. You can draw up a 15-word constitutional amendment that would legitimize and dignify tribalism, and that can be for you what the Aboriginal flag is in Australia. It can be your banner, even though it is a set of words. And if it is set out plainly and evocatively, it can be done. The other thing I would say to you about constitutional amendments is we do need to take a broader view of it. Right now, the constitutional amendment we think of is the ERA, with all the churning it caused and the fact that it didn't go through. The fact is there's a whole other set of constitutional amendments, relatively technical ones, changing the age to 18, allowing the vote in District of Columbia, that went through very quickly. And so maybe, just maybe, a constitutional amendment could not only be a symbol, but it could fall into that class of technical, non-controversial amendments. I don't mean to suggest that. I just mean to say that the ERA isn't the only kind of constitutional amendments. The idea of state law, which as a protection, and by the way, no one needs to denigrate the North Slope borough to argue for tribalism. You can have both. They aren't mutually exclusive. So we're not in a debate here over which is better or which one we should have, the North Slope borough idea or the tribalism idea. You can have both if you choose. But the idea of the home rule community under state law meets my test as being initially acceptable because it is a tribalism concept. Really what David and others would suggest is that you take the concept of tribalism, you move it into a home rule municipality under state law. It has the advantage that if you can build consensus in this state, which I know is a long way away, but if you can build it, it goes through easier than it does through Congress. And so, sure, that's a model, and it ought to be talked about. But the third approach seems to me the one you are most likely to adopt, and that is federalizing tribalism in some sort of federal protections. The federal protections are harder to come by because Congress is larger, it's more complex, but that also provides you with greater protection. And the fact is that the new people in this state, subsistence hunters and fishers who are your competitors out there simply have far more attenuated influence in Washington, D.C. than they do in Juneau. And so you get better protection from a federal law, and my guess is you will want to go that way. Now, some brief comments on what the federal protections might look like, and I think I'm really going to suggest an approach toward it rather than a menu of protections. The first thing I would say to you, I will just throw out one bit of my own experience. The Menominee Restoration, again, is so parallel to your situation legally and policy-wise that it's painful. It's not as complicated. There was less land, just one tribe. But legally, they did the same thing. They terminated the Menominees in about the same way they terminated you. And we had the problem of getting land from a state corporation back into trust. It was my job to draw up that document, which was a long and technical document. And what I did, working out of the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder, Colorado, was to become a Wisconsin corporate lawyer. And I spent more time in Wisconsin that year than I did home. And I took on some corporate lawyers as consultants. I learned the Wisconsin corporate code inside out. And about 4 months into that, I concluded that it's nice to know some Wisconsin corporate law, but this is an Indian law problem, not a Wisconsin corporate law problem. And you're going to find the same thing with ANCSA. I'm delighted you bring in the corporate lawyers. I think it's terrific. I think they can provide needed depth and expertise to this. But the truth is, this is an Indian law problem, and don't let anyone tell you that Congress can't work on this with almost complete flexibility. It can. You may have trouble deciding what you want, but once you decide, Congress has the power to do it without taking vested rights. It may not be exactly that simple, but it's close to it, and it's better to state that as the law than it is to pretend that there's a set of complexities out there that bar you. And as soon as we realized that in Menominee, I started turning to Reed Chambers, who was an associate solicitor there, and started making deals with him instead of making deals with the Wisconsin corporate commissioners, and things started to move real fast, didn't they, Reed? Yes. Well, yeah, that's true, too. But we won't comment on the current solicitor's office. In federalizing tribalism, please go about it this way. Forget the idea that there's a unitary body of federal law of tribalism. For most of the lower 48 tribes, it is unitary, just because that's the way it has been done. Most of their the trust at Fort Berthold tends to be the same as the trust at Le Coudre in Wisconsin. But
except in Barrow,
it's different in Barrow. Okay, it is different in Barrow. I agree with that. Let me, for example, and someone else could make maybe a better list, but it's helpful, I think, to show that there is a list. It seems to me we were talking about the trust earlier. There isn't the trust. There are elements to the trust, and I will lay out 8 of them here. And my idea is that what you can do is pick and choose among these elements, and maybe some others, and pick the ones you like for recommendations and have your own kind of trust relationship and reject the ones you don't like. But some elements are these. Trust land is non-taxable. Trust land is non-transferable. Trust land can't be mortgaged. The United States has an obligation to permit mismanagement. You can't sue a tribe over trust assets because of sovereign immunity. The United States must provide services to implement the trust. Trust assets are exempt from state jurisdiction. Trust assets are managed by the tribes. Now, what you can do is have a trust relationship that allows your tribes to waive sovereign immunity for suits. You can do that, and you can have any kind of waiver you want, as long as it's done through Congress, where I think you're going to have to go. Similarly, you can, and again, I think that the single best thing that has come out of ANCSA, potentially, that the tribes in the lower 48 are most interested about is your liquidity of assets. You can provide for a degree of liquidity to allow a tribe to mortgage a percentage of its assets or certain assets. You can do that, and because Congress can define the trust. The trust is not an all or nothing thing. It's a series of building blocks. Pick the ones you want, dispense with the ones you don't want. Same thing with hunting and fishing rights. You have some elements now of federal hunting and fishing rights, mainly through ANILCA. You have some protections. But hunting and fishing rights have other elements to them. One of them is freedom from state regulation. You don't have that. That's one of the basic things a hunting and fishing right is in the lower 48. You don't have that. Second, tribes can regulate hunting and fishing on their lands. You don't have that. Third, and this is most important, and you must press for this, tribes in the lower 48 can hunt and fish commercially. And for those of you who have been stuffed into a state system on commercial harvesting of salmon, to me that's a tragedy. Maybe that's never going to get changed, but recognize that's an element of the classic hunting and fishing right under federal law that is lacking for you. So I urge you to go about it that way, to look at there being a whole menu of attributes of federalized tribalism. You can take some and not take others. You can create your own kind of tribalism with federal protection if you choose to go that way. One last comment. Tom asked very appropriately, how should the commission recommend that changes to what group of people should be able to recommend changes to the ANCSA regional corporations? Should it be the shareholders? I say no. I say that you should start again looking at tribal members. Don't look at Alaska Natives for the source of your, at shareholders for the source of your reform. Look to Alaska Natives and recognize the fact that people born after 71 are Alaska Natives also. So to the extent possible, and I think it's not a legal issue, you should look at that as the basic consensus group. Ultimately, what I'm suggesting to you is that too many legal and governmental commission reports are clinical and technical and tedious. This report, because of its subject matter and the time and place in which it is being handed down, must be first and foremost a moral document. It should not be overdrawn or exaggerated, but it must set out a moral imperative. We must recognize that much of what this commission will do will be to recommend laws, or part of it anyway, will be to recommend laws. Law is derivative. Law comes from other things. It comes from history. It comes from anthropology, science, economics, and it comes from morality. It comes from the perceived values of the society. This report, as much as any report I have dealt with in my professional career, should be a call to everything that is good and progressive in this society. It should summon out the best in us as a people. That is idealistic, but there are times when it is not pragmatic to ignore idealism. And that is because ideals are real things, and pragmatists deal with real things. Ideals exist, and sometimes we ignore them, but other times they control law and policy when movements build, and this may be a time in which that is happening. And if you ignore that moral imperative, you may lose your chance for the kind of fundamental reform you deserve. This subject deserves a daring report. To be sure, it needs data and statistics and economic and social proof, but it also must soar. This commission has developed a kind of integrity that few bodies that I have seen in my professional experience have achieved. I believe there is an honest chance that it can collect together scattered ideas, that it can build a moral and political consensus, and it can construct a kind of change that is so progressive and so fundamental that most of us in this room would not even dare to cross over into believing right now that that kind of change can happen. But I believe it can happen, and I think that this commission report can be the engine for that kind of change.
Well, thank you, Charles. I think that if you don't mind, Sheldon, I think we might break now for lunch and come back at 2 o'clock and carry on then for a couple of hours. And after lunch, we'll call on Sheldon, and then I'd like to give Ralph Lerner a chance to talk about the issue that Rosita raised and other things that may be on his mind, and then turn to some others. So we'll come back at 2 o'clock. Let's make it 2 o'clock sharp. I thought that might be a hard speech to follow. Well, how'd you like to draft something to those specifications?
Well, your draft.
Oh, he's actually, I'm on the same wavelength.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't.
Archie, do you want to say something this afternoon?
They've turned the fan off, so I think that means we can begin. Let me make a suggestion for this afternoon. We're going to be holding a... Maybe I could just tell you what the commission plans for the new year. We're going to hold a hearing in Bethel in sometime in February, I believe, and we'll be going down to Dillingham as well. And we're going to have a hearing in Anchorage here for the Alaska Native people and others living here in the Anchorage area. And that will be, I think, in February. I'm not sure of the dates. But some of you who are eager to speak at this gathering, we hope that you will speak at the hearing in Anchorage. I believe not only Alaska Natives want to speak at the hearing in Anchorage, but some folks from some of the local churches and so on. So don't get the idea that when we adjourn at 4 o'clock today, that or 4:15, don't get the idea that that's the end of the commission's activities in Anchorage. And then there is another round table in mid-March of 1985, and that'll be the last round table. And at that time, we hope to look at the, in a very broad way, the question of the place of Native people in the Western world. And, well, watch for bulletins about that one. We're still working on it. And that will conclude the work of the commission, and the report will, I believe, and it is, we have stayed on schedule throughout, and I believe that the report will be ready by September 1st, 1985, and will be in your hands. So what I was about to say was that I hope this afternoon, if you will allow me to say so, I would like to make sure that our guests from the lower 48 and other countries have a crack at the microphones so that we get the most out of them that that we can before they leave. And I want to say now, if I may, I know some of them have left already, but certainly I appreciate what all the guests from the lower 48 and the other countries have contributed to this roundtable. I appreciate, of course, what Alaskans have contributed as well, but I just thought I should thank our guests on your behalf. So what I was going to say was that this afternoon you might, perhaps we might allow Ralph Lerner to open up. And I asked Ralph to come because he came to our roundtable in March this year. And he acted as devil's advocate in the argument that we had then, and he did it very well. That is, he wanted us all to make sure we didn't get carried away in a wave of enthusiasm without understanding that there are some very real questions that other folks are going to ask in the years to come. And Ralph's pretty good at putting those questions, so I thought we might ask him to lead off this afternoon, throw the cat among the pigeons, so to speak, and then I'll ask Sheldon and others to respond, and if Browning Pipestem would, and Ralph Johnson and others, please feel free. Larry, I you're from Anchorage now, so we don't need to treat you as a guest, I suppose. Oh, so Ralph, you lead off, would you please?
I've just discovered that I've been typecast, and I should, though with an act of, in a kind manner, since I was presented as a devil's advocate, as distinguished from the devil. I'm going to say some things that, you know, may not be welcome to everyone, or maybe not to anyone, for different reasons. But I'm not going to present my observations and their only observations in that kind of lean and linear way that Mr. Williams did. I mean, that was very impressive. This is going to be rather more episodic and subjective. First of all, I should say that if you don't like what I say, it's not because I'm giving advice. I'm the one truly non-expert here among all the people on the panel. So I have no advice to give that you have to dislike. On the other hand, I am an invited guest, and I suppose that Mr. Berger didn't invite me to be flattering. For that, I don't have to travel 3,000 miles. Looking around the room, and I've tried to be attentive and not only listening to people, but especially the native peoples, but looking at their faces and, you know, seeing if you can look into somebody's eyes and try to see what kind of a human soul is behind it. I'm just flabbergasted by the variety of human types. When I was here in March, I raised, one of my nasty questions was a question I thought that no expert could answer for any of the native peoples. You know, what is Inuit? What is Aleut? What is Indian? But these were questions they could only answer for themselves, and that everything had to begin with that, that lawyers and investment counselors were only a late resource. But I think that the way I put the question then was probably too simple. It seems that the variety of types here is just greater than anything that is familiar to me from the U.S. That the differences, say, between a black farmer in near Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and a Cambodian boat person living in Chicago, or a Hasidic Jew in New York, or a pleasure seeker in Malibu, California, that those differences aren't nearly as great as the kinds of differences that exist among the native peoples here. I'm not talking about different tribes. I'm talking about individuals and their differences. That there's such a variety of human needs here, and that there has to be a corresponding variety of modes of trying to satisfy those needs. But that means it's very messy and very complicated. And generally speaking, the temptation is to try to simplify, to unify, and to homogenize, to try to find the solution. Simply because it's so hard to keep so many variations in mind and to deal with them in any effective way. But although there is this kind of necessity because we're so incapable of keeping a million different things in hand and dealing with them all, there's a possibility and indeed a likelihood that the categories, the cubbyholes in which we stuff people and problems, try to reduce, you know, a vast number to a smaller number, a more manageable number, that those categories themselves become tyrannical, that they manage us. And accordingly, that the means that we adopt, the instruments, the tools,